Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tropical Storm Bonnie is heading towards southern Florida after leaving floods in Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, and Haiti. Seas are choppy in the Gulf of Mexico with waves as high as 5 feet rocking the boats cleaning up from the BP oil disaster. Ships have been ordered to leave the area, and the attempt to permanently plug the oil well is stalled for now. Donna Leinwand is USA Today's disaster reporter, and she joins us on the line right now. Donna, can you start by telling us where are we with the tropical storm right now? What are our officials saying about how bad the weather might get?
Well, Tropical Storm Bonnie is sitting right now in the middle of Biscayne Bay off the coast of South Florida, and the winds stretch out about 85 miles out from the center, so the folks in South Florida are starting to feel the storm. The wind is about 40 miles per hour, which makes it just barely a tropical storm. It becomes a tropical storm at 39 miles per hour, and there are some gusts at 46 miles. And it's actually moving across the state, and it's going to, tonight, start moving into the Gulf of Mexico, expected on the west coast of Florida and then the northern Gulf of Mexico.
And what are forecasters saying about how bad it might get?
Well, storms generally don't strengthen over land. What they need is the warm water. So right now it's probably going to stay at 40 miles per hour winds, but by the time it gets over the Gulf, it's going to start picking up strength. It may reach hurricane strength, it may not.
Can you tell us what's happening at the oil spill site right now? Any ships still there?
Oh, yeah. It takes quite a while to start detaching all the ships and the rigs. So last night at 8 p.m., Admiral Thad Allen, who's the guy, the incident commander in charge of the response for the government, made the decision that the storm was definitely going to come very close to the drilling site and that the ships would need to get to safe harbor. So some of the equipment there, some of the rigs take 8 to 12 hours to detach. So they actually started doing that. The more complicated ones are still in that process, and some of the smaller support ships are already heading towards safe harbor.
And because of this, it's affecting plans to permanently cap the well and to clean up the oil that's in the water.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely going to create some delays there. You know, they have stopped working on capping the well, and especially on drilling the relief well while they're removing this equipment. So right now, that kind of work has stopped to remove the equipment and get everybody to safe harbor. And so once that's done, that takes, you know, a day or two, and then they have to wait for the storm to pass. It's actually a fairly quick-moving storm. It's moving 18 miles per hour west-northwest. So they feel like the storm will pass in, you know, 24 to 48 hours, and then they have to get back there again and reattach everything. So they're going to be losing, I would say, 3 to 5 days.
At least.
At least.
And without any ships out there, and if the storm does get bad, it means that well is not being monitored. Is that right?
That is correct. I mean, definitely the monitoring has been very, very important to the whole response. And they have to move those monitoring ships and monitoring equipment out of the way. And so we won't really know what's happening out there. In the meantime, there's still plenty of oil out in the Gulf, and the skimming operations are not happening. And so, you know, the hurricane comes into the Gulf, and it's kind of like a washing machine. It churns up the Gulf. And so depending on which way the wind hits, it can push the oil either out to sea, or it could push the oil inland, and then it could end up on the beaches. Right now, the hurricane warning is stretching from Destin, Florida, which is the Florida panhandle, all the way to Morgan City, Louisiana, and that is a really wide swath of land that is, you know, that is preparing for storm surge. And the storm surge actually could be up to 3 to 5 feet in the northern Gulf, which is Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, which is pretty much the last thing they need right now.
I'd just like to go back to the monitoring of what's happening at the well. What do Coast Guard officials say about the fact that this storm is going to remove the monitoring of the well and the cap that there have been some questions about?
Well, they're very... you know, distressed that they have to do this, but they know that it's something that they have to do because we are in the middle of hurricane season.
Mm.
And Thad Allen said last night that the monitoring equipment should be the last to leave and the first to return in order to maximize the monitoring of the well. And I will quote him. He said last night that monitoring of the site during the well integrity test remains one of the government's highest priorities.
All right. All right. Donna Linewan, disaster reporter for USA Today. Thanks very much for being with us. And as you said, this is the middle of hurricane season, so we'll probably be talking to you again.
My pleasure, Deborah. Thanks so much.
We want to turn now to some of the unseen damage from the BP disaster, the emotional toll on Gulf residents. Last month, Alan Cruz, a fishing boat captain in Alabama, committed suicide. His family says his death was directly related to the oil mess. Louisiana Congressman Charlie Melancon has called on BP to fund efforts to address mental health problems. He says after the disaster, one mental health facility in his district referred more than 1,500 people for counseling because of signs of depression and anxiety. Joining us is a man who is looking for those signs. Stephen Piku is a sociologist at the University of South Alabama. For 20 years, he studied the psychological effects of the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. Now, he's assessing the emotional impact of what's happened in the Gulf. Professor Piku joins us now from his home in Orange Beach, Alabama. Welcome, Professor.
Glad to be here.
You've been traveling around the Gulf region and you've been speaking with mental health professionals. What are you hearing from them?
Well, in some communities, there's been a significant spike in calls to the police department. For example, in the community of Bayou La Batra, Alabama, they've had to add staff to their police force because of the high volume of calls. We've also had reports from various mental health agencies, including private agencies such as Lakeview Center in Pensacola, Florida, where they're seeing a very real spike in calls, as well as the use of the oil spill crisis hotline. So essentially, what we have is a situation that's very similar to what we observed in 1989 in Prince William Sound, Alaska. You have very independent, self-reliant, hardworking people who have essentially lost their jobs.
Explain to me specifically, if you would, why it is that we're seeing these particular forms of mental health issues and why it is similar to Exxon Valdez.
The reason that we're seeing these community, family, and mental health outcomes is that people are in a situation where their future is highly uncertain. They've lost a way of life. Now, this is a very intangible kind of statement, and it flies under the radar. But what you're talking about is that the meaning of this way of life has been essentially taken away from people. And these are generational fishers, and they were planning on passing their fishing lifestyle onto their children. So to take away a lifestyle and a way of life results in incredibly serious problems. It certainly severely impacts the family since it creates an unstable family situation with divorces, rises in domestic violence, and of course severe clinical depression, symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, anger, and high severe anxiety are all characteristics that we've documented before in Alaska and for other technological accidents such as Three Mile Island and Bhopal and Love Canal and places like that.
So basically, when it's a technological or man-made disaster, if you will, as opposed to a natural disaster, are the mental health issues then different because of the trust issues involved, and they feel that they were even more violated because someone's to blame?
Right, and you put your finger on a very important problem, because what happens is that communities lose what we refer to as social capital. And such a community with a loss of social capital means several things. Number one, there is loss of trust. I mean, people already clearly do not trust BP, the Coast Guard, the federal government. State government has lost a lot of trust among the survivors. And this kind of dwindles down to local government and eventually neighbors and relatives. In addition to that, social networks, including family and friendship and other organizational networks in the community, breaks down. Now, the reason that this occurs, which we clearly document in our research in Alaska, is that people begin in a situation where there is no therapeutic community. After a natural disaster, a therapeutic community emerges, and that is a community that builds social capital. People cooperate, they trust one another, they work together, they try to rebuild better than they were before the storm or the earthquake. But as communities corrode and fragment, you have a situation of social conflict. And it all begins with the fact that some people in these communities are selected to lease their boats or work on the cleanup, whereas other people don't. This sort of draws a line in the sand in the community, marginalizes certain people. In Alaska, they were called spillionaires. So essentially, the same type of pattern is emerging here. There's been conflict in communities over who has had the opportunity to participate in the Vessels of Opportunity program sponsored by BP. We've seen media accounts of people that have been on the list for 3 months, and they don't understand why. Of course, after that, what we documented in Alaska, the economic impacts persisted as the ecosystem impacts unfolded. The herring fishery in Prince William Sound collapsed 4 years after the spill, and it never has returned. So since 1993, people who had herring fishing permits have not fished, and this was a very significant, substantial economic blow to the communities up in Prince William Sound. So who knows, in terms of the unfolding ecosystem impacts that we will be observing probably over the next decade or longer, what the economic consequences will be for people who make their living harvesting or taking other people out for recreational fishing in the Gulf of Mexico.
Stephen Piku, a sociologist at the University of South Alabama who studied the psychological effects of the Exxon Valdez oil spill and is now turning his attention to his neighbors in the Gulf. And Stephen, I want to ask you about Alabama boat captain Alan Cruz, whose suicide his family says is directly related to the BP disaster. What does this tragedy say about the mental health issues that start to present themselves after a disaster like this?
The first suicide that we had in Cordova, Alaska, and it was 4 years after the spill. I must say that the tragic suicide of Captain Cruz shocked me, because it was almost like we've got Exxon Valdez fast forward. This was on the 65th day, and it was apparent at that moment that the mental health problems and the family problems and the problems in our communities were rapidly becoming acute and needed some kind of proactive response.
There is a big difference between the Gulf and Alaska, and that, of course, is Hurricane Katrina, because many Gulf residents are still trying to recover from that. So this is almost like a double whammy here for some Gulf residents. Does that exacerbate mental health issues?
That's a very good point, and there's bad news and good news when you think about Katrina. Now, the bad news is, yes, people are just at the point of recovery. They have just rebuilt their businesses, their homes. They're also a part of the economic downturn over the last 3 years, and most people early on in February and March were expecting a banner year in terms of commercial fishing, charter boat fishing, as well as tourism. So there was this very, very high degree of optimism that was also present. And of course, the spill was kind of the second shoe dropping. And I know a number of people are thinking to themselves, why me? Why now? How can I overcome this incredible catastrophe? That's the bad news, and it does show increased vulnerability. At the same time, there's some good news, because post-Katrina Gulf Coast is characterized by a large number of volunteer organizations that have been assembled and that did incredible positive recovery work after the storm. Now, hopefully, because this is post-Katrina kind of in place, that we'll have a better chance to mitigate some of the community impacts, family impacts, and in particularly the mental health impacts.
What do you tell folks about how long it might take before things feel normal again?
In Alaska, our data collection ran from 1989 to 2009. And we found in 2006 and 2009 that there were significant levels of stress and depression and uncertainty, and still perceptions that the community was fragmented.
20 years later.
Now, this was related, it's important, because one of the things that we wanted to do by having the first rigorous empirical collection of data with regards to a technological disaster over 20 years was to try to determine, what is the driving engine of this continuing stress? I mean, why can't people get over this? And what we found was that about 1995 to 2000, the source of the stress changed. It shifted from the oil spill itself to the litigation that continued for 16 years.
Stephen Pikiu, a sociologist at the University of South Alabama and an expert on the psychological effects caused by the Exxon Valdez oil spill. He's now assessing the emotional impact of the BP disaster in the Gulf. Professor, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. I was certainly happy to be with you today.
Well, let's get a couple of your thoughts in. We heard from a lot of listeners about this week's conversation with journalist Emily Bazelon about 15-year-old Phoebe Prince's suicide. Six teenagers from Massachusetts face charges in her death, from civil rights violations to statutory rape. Bazelon's article says Prince had a history of mental illness, and many listeners thought our conversation was insensitive to the victim. Ellen George left a message on our listener line.
I feel that Phoebe Prince was bullied and abused by the kids at South Hadley High, and they should be punished in some way. It is also untrue that these kids face a 10-year prison sentence. My husband was a retired police chief, and I know this to be a fact. They will get a slap on the hand.
And Aviva thought we should have been tougher on Bazelon about her sources. The rigor of our interview, Aviva posted, did not rise to the level of the seriousness of the subject. This week, we reported on attempts by scientists to move sea turtle eggs out of the way of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. Janet asked, when will we and biologists learn that interference does more harm than good? Moving the turtles, Janet writes, will likely result in their deaths, giving their very sensitive hatching cycle. She asks, how much harm has to continue to happen to our ecosystem due to rash decisions by biologists? And finally, we asked you to tell us about your favorite summer blockbuster films after our conversation on the 35th anniversary of Jaws. A couple of you voted for Tim Burton's film Batman. Eddie writes, I remember being 10. My friends and I were thrilled that The Dark Knight was finally coming to the big screen. One of Deirdre Martin's favorite films from summer's past was Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. She says she'll never forget it. And here and now, 2001 fans can't forget the film's evil computer, HAL.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
By the way, if you're a fan of the film, check out our 2008 interview with the film star Keir DeLay. It's on our website, hereandnow.org. And Dan's favorite summertime film was 1987's Dirty Dancing. Back after the news, here and now. For the first time since the Soviet Union collapsed almost 20 years ago, large numbers of Russians are heading back to their former Cold War ally, Cuba. This time, though, they're going as tourists rather than military and political advisors. A newly confident Russia is starting to reestablish ties with Cuba. As the BBC's correspondent in Havana, Michael Voss, reports, for many of these visitors, the island offers a nostalgic trip with glimpses into many Russians' own recent past.
Cuba may be famous for all the old American cars still on the roads, but they're outnumbered by Soviet-built larders. For more than 30 years, Moscow helped keep Fidel Castro's revolution alive, subsidizing this communist-run island on America's doorstep. At its peak, there were 20,000 Soviets stationed here, men like construction engineer Yevgeny Glotov, who for the first time has returned with his grandson, for a package holiday.
I wanted to bring my grandson because I have so many happy memories from my time here. And Cuba still sustains the socialist line. There are new buildings, but otherwise it hasn't changed. I have deep feelings for it.
Loretta Aldama is Yevgeny's Cuban tour guide. In the 1970s, she won a scholarship to study in the former Soviet Union. But it's only in the past couple of years that Loretta Aldama has been able to use her Russian skills again.
They have different tastes. They are looking for different things. And they are very happy when they see their cars, Russian cars, still running in our street. The first question they made to me when they come to Cuba is, how is Fidel Castro? We want to know about Fidel Castro because we love Fidel Castro.
Buenos días!
Buenos días!
Every morning, primary school children line up in assembly to chant, "We are the pioneers of communism. We will be like Che." They're dressed in red and white pioneer uniforms with their distinctive red neck scarves, just as children did back in the former Soviet Union. And for tourist Mariana Rezova, sights like these offer a nostalgic reminder of her own childhood.
I used to be a pioneer and wear the exact same uniform. My daughter has never seen one. There are no pioneers anymore. I have many friends in Moscow who were based in Cuba in the 80s, and they recommended that I come here. I'm really glad we did.
It's not all nostalgia. Much of their time is spent on Cuba's palm-fringed beaches. 2.5 million tourists come here each year, mainly Canadians and Europeans. The number of Russians remains small but growing fast. 30,000 last year, 45,000 this. There is still one group who are unable to enjoy the mojitos and music, like this eight-piece band playing barefoot in the sand. Before the revolution, this was America's tropical playground. Only under US law, they're not allowed to travel here. It has to be one of the last vestiges of the Cold War.
That report from the BBC's Michael Voss in Havana. And this sad note now, Daniel Shore, longtime senior news analyst for NPR and veteran Washington journalist who broke major stories at home and abroad, has died. Shore's 20-year career as a foreign correspondent began in 1946. He was a reporter, he was a commentator, he was hired by What was then the fledgling CNN in 1979. In 1985, his contract was not renewed there, and at that point, he joined National Public Radio. Longtime senior news analyst for NPR, Daniel Schorr, died at his home in Washington today. He was 93 years old. You're listening to Here and Now. What would summer be without festivals? Over the next month, we're going to be touching down in communities across the country to talk about different festivals. This weekend in Gilroy, California, there's the annual Garlic Festival. In Timonium, Maryland, it's the 110th German Festival. And in Whiting, Indiana, just outside Chicago, they're holding the 16th annual Pierogi Festival. Pierogies are big in that part of the country because of its Polish heritage. The festival draws about 200,000 people. The master of ceremonies is a man who dresses up in a big white pierogi costume, and he calls himself Mr. Pierogi. His real name is top secret, but he's joining us on the line right now. Welcome, Mr. Pierogi.
It's kind of a misnomer that there's a man that dresses up in a suit. A lot of people think that, but Mr. Pierogi is himself. He's there all year. It's his one job, so it's not like there is a secret identity to him. He just is Mr. Pierogi.
Well, what is a pierogi?
A pierogi is, it's a stuffed dumpling. It's like a pot sticker, almost, but it's dough filled with any sort of goodness you can think of, meats, cheeses, fruits. They do them as desserts. They were originally created because in some of the poor sections of Poland, it was difficult to find foods to eat, so to create dough-filled anything you had around was very, very easy. So that's how it just kind of came to be the standard Polish food.
And typically, in America, we see them potato-filled. Is that right?
Potato-filled is very, very common.
You're celebrating, Mr. Pierogi, with other folks who also are wearing clothing that looks like Polish treats. And one of them is Miss Punczki, also on the line with us. And you actually are giving us your identity because you do have another job. You're the head of the Chamber of Commerce, and your name is Mary Lou Gregor. Is that right?
That is correct. And of course, you know, the reason is that I cannot maintain this 365 a year because I would not be fresh. And no one wants a bakery treat that is stale. I have to be re-powder sugared and prepped and filled. So that's the whole reason. I can't do this year-round. It would just, you know, we would go stale.
Wait, well, why don't you tell us, what's a punczki?
A punczki is a jelly-filled donut. And it was always served on Fat Tuesday, the day before Ash Wednesday. And since at that time the people did not have refrigeration that would last all through Lent, they used up everything that they weren't going to give up for Lent. So the butter and sweets and all that got created into the lovely punczki.
And you literally are dressed up like a punczki.
They have given me a complete makeover, and I now really do look exactly like a jelly roll, complete with the powdered sugar. And I will be covered in the powdered sugar by the end of the event, and so will everyone who hugs me or whatever. It just really, it does flake off. So they'll probably every night when the festival closes and you think we go to sleep, actually they have me rolling through the powdered sugar so I can prepare for the next day.
Well, I wonder, you must be a bit of a celebrity because of your role during this festival.
People walk up and want to take their photographs with us, pose, smile, kiss, hug. It's very weird because you don't think of a piece of food as a celebrity, but it is in this area, and it really is quite a treat to be that.
I was born 13 years ago, so this is actually my baker's dozen birthday of this year, which I'm super excited
about.
Happy
birthday!
Thank you. But when I was first born, you know, people weren't quite sure what to make of me as Mr. Pierogi. And over the last 13 years, it's just grown exponentially. And, you know, I've been fortunate to have been joined by Miss Punczki. We're also joined by the Halupki guy, who is stuffed cabbage. We make sure that there is something for everybody to enjoy when you come out and visit us.
But, Mr. Pierogi, why do you think that people come to the festival to see you and to get their pictures taken with you?
Honestly, we've had multiple conversations about this, and I really do think that it comes down to the fact that this is one of the few festivals that really does celebrate our heritage in a great way. Anybody who is raised in an Eastern European family can relate to, and it brings back those memories of childhood and things like that. I've got two or three different families that will send me Christmas cards every year, and it's just a great feeling. It really does warm the heart.
The festival actually kicks off today, and there will be a parade tonight. Can you tell
Correct.
Me what will be happening? I understand that there's a twirling babushka brigade.
Do you want to take that, Mr. Pierogi, or do you want me to?
Oh, no, no. I think that you're very well suited to talk about
this. All right. Well, our bushas, which is the term for grandma, dressed in the proper attire, which is the rolled-down stockings, the house dresses, curlers in the hair, red lipstick with just a little bit on the teeth, because that's how it would be. And they do twirl, actually plungers and mops and brooms. And they go and kind of polka through the parade, and which is part of the reason it's called the Polka Parade. They are a fun-filled group. I've never met such crazy people.
Toilet plungers, they're
toilet. Toilet plungers, yes, that is correct.
Mm-hmm. And on the flip side of that, we also have the Precision Lawnmower Brigade, which is the men who come out dressed as our fathers and our grandfathers did in the shorts and the sandals and the black socks. And they have a very precision dance that they do with their lawnmowers. And each one is very, very unique. And the great thing about this entire parade is it really is the antithesis of any parade that you have ever seen. It doesn't take itself incredibly seriously. We realize that we all have a heritage, and then there are certain things that we remember, and there are certain things that we can poke fun at ourselves and have fun and say, do you remember when Grandma used to have the lipstick on her teeth? Do you remember when Dad used to mow the lawn in his socks? And we really celebrate that. And that's the great thing about this parade, and I think that's what everybody loves about it, is the fact that it does give you a chance to take a look at your heritage, remember it, and laugh about it.
Now, you know, there are areas in New York, in Pennsylvania, Ohio, that call themselves the pierogi capital. I don't really think that there's anybody who quite has a festival like you do, but I did read that Binghamton, New York last year was named the pierogi capital of the U.S.
Yes, Mrs. Tease was doing some sort of contest, if I remember correctly.
So is there a bit of a competition there?
Well, the last year that it was done was 2008. And that was when New York had won. And so we said we were putting all our burners on and coming out to really, we were not going to take second place to them again. And suddenly the contest got canceled.
Oh.
So I really feel that they felt threatened by us, and rightfully so. So what can I say? They ran scared.
Well, maybe better luck in the future.
There you go.
Well, Miss Poonsky, Mr. Pierogi, thanks very much. You're the mascots of Whiting, Indiana's Pierogi Festival. And to see photos of them, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. I'd like to thank both of you for being with us, and have a good festival this weekend.
Thank you so much.
Well,
drive on down.
We have people
travel a lot farther than just from Boston, let me tell you.
Okay. Well, you never know. Thanks very much.
Okay. All right.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. We're going to be touching down at festivals throughout this summer, and we want to hear from you. Go to our Facebook page called WBUR's Here and Now. Tell us about your festival, post photos and videos, and we may end up featuring your local festival on the air. Again, that's WBUR's Here and Now on Facebook. Back after a break, Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Fans of the Emmy Award-winning show Mad Men have been waiting since last fall to hear this music again. The show about hard-working, hard-drinking, heavy-smoking Madison Avenue ad executives in the 1960s begins its fourth season Sunday night. At the end of last season, the core characters left their old firm and started a new one. As they struggled to find clients, they also wrestled with fundamental questions like, who am I? A question put to main character Don Draper by a reporter in the season premiere.
Who is Don Draper?
What do men say when you ask that?
Well, they usually take a minute to think about it, and then they do something cute. One creative director said he was a lion tamer.
I don't want to do that.
Anything? I mean, now's your chance.
Well, as I said before, I'm from the Midwest. You were taught that it's not polite to talk about yourself.
Watching an episode of Mad Men is like stepping into the early 60s. Men are sexist, environmentalism is unheard of, and the sets are filled with period details, such as double-breasted suits and jeweled lipstick holders. The characters look the part, but sometimes the writers slip and throw 21st century dialogue into Cold War-era conversations. Ben Zimmer, the on-language columnist for the Sunday New York Times Magazine, looks at some of the show's linguistic anachronisms in this weekend's magazine. And he joins us from New York. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. You know, there are a lot of websites dedicated to trying to root out some of the anachronisms, whether it's the props or the dialogue. Why do you think that Mad Men has spawned this kind of scrutiny?
They've really set themselves up as a show by and for perfectionists, I think. From the very beginning, people were aware that Matthew Weiner, the creator of the show, and all of his staff were being very meticulous with everything from set decoration to the props and wardrobe to language. And they've really tried to hold the show to a very high standard. And the fans are keeping to that by looking for any little errors they might be able to spot.
And you've spotted some. We have a scene here from season one. It's supposed to take place in 1960, and it's with the office manager, Joan. She's telling another secretary, Peggy, that the managers want her to try writing some ad copy.
Congratulations. More work and more responsibility. I guess you'll be entitled to some dinner money. That's swell. Maybe I should go and thank them?
I'm not really dressed. Tomorrow, maybe?
No need. They wanted me to tell you. They were very specific about it.
Oh.
Well, you know what they say. The medium is the message.
So that line, Ben Zimmer, the medium is the message? Marshall McLuhan line, so out of place.
Just a bit out of place. Mm. Marshall McLuhan didn't use it in print until 1964, so that's 4 years after Joan uses the line. It's possible he was using it when he was teaching. I believe he was teaching up in Canada at the time, but I don't think Joan would have been able to hear it unless she was a student of his. The creator, Matthew Weiner, has owned up to this. He says that he regrets having Joan say that. They realized after the fact that that was just not right for the time period.
Joan also, at the end of season one, said, "I'm so over you." Show creator Matthew Weiner points to the Cole Porter song, "So in Love."
The stars fill the sky, so in love with you am I.
What's the quibble with saying, "I'm so over you"?
Well, that particular use of "so" is a bit modern. The use of the adverb "so" certainly could be used, as in the Cole Porter song, "So in Love." But in that case, "so" gets used as a way of quantifying the extent of something, like the extent that a person is in love, where there's a kind of a comparison going on, or a relative degree. But when you say, "I'm so over you," that's more of a Generation X-style use of the word "so," where it's really just being used as an intensifier, like extremely or completely. So that, especially the way that Joan uses it in her intonation, struck a lot of people as a bit too modern.
Can I just say nitpicky? Can I say that, Ben? Don't you think that's a little nitpicky?
Well, absolutely, but that's the sort of thing that people do when they watch the show. They're ready to pick up on any little thing that might cross their linguistic radar. They'll check the Oxford English Dictionary or something like that. And that's the same process that the creators and writers of the show are going through when they're vetting the scripts, when they're checking out all the words and phrases in the dialogue that they've written to make sure that it's right. I was interested to hear that there's absolutely no room for improvisation on the show. The actors really just have to stick to the script because the scripts have been so carefully constructed. The main goal, Weiner told me, is to make sure that there aren't things that jolt the audience into thinking, wait, that can't be right. And so that's why they go over everything with a fine-tooth comb.
You know, there was one thing that you mentioned in your column that I thought was interesting, too. Roger Sterling, one of the partners at the firm, uses the line, "I know you have to be on the same page as him."
What's wrong, Roger?
Well, it's about his contract.
What about it?
Look, I know you have to be on the same page as him. He's your husband.
When did that phrase become popular?
to be on the same page as someone else. The Oxford English Dictionary dates that usage to 1979. There was a sports article from that year talking about the NFL, saying it takes a long time for everybody to get on the same page as far as the rules are concerned. So that's the earliest known example of that, and we know that it really became popular, particularly in business circles, in the 80s and 90s. So for Roger to be saying that in 1963, I think is pretty clearly out of place.
Why do you think Mad Men strikes such a chord with people?
Well, in part, I think that Mad Men captures a kind of a mythology, perhaps, about a certain era in America's past. And you get engaged with the characters and you want to see what happens as they go through this extremely turbulent time in American history and the way that things like gender relations are going to change and the way that language changes, too. I'm really excited to see the way that the writing of the show reflects those changes just through dialogue, obviously. The way that people were talking in the early 60s, there were a lot of social inhibitions or social norms prescribing how people should speak. I mean, those things changed a fair bit over those years.
Are there any specific examples of how you think you would like to see language used in the show as it goes forward?
Well, one interesting aspect of language is cursing, and there's been a limited amount of cursing on the show so far, and we can expect to see more of that as we progress through the 60s And again, the social norms about cursing definitely changed in the when people thought it was appropriate to curse. But of course, the show is on AMC. It's not on HBO, so it will still have a limited place on the show, but it will be very interesting to see how they negotiate that and in terms of the way that the 60s kind of liberalized the use of language.
Well, Ben Zimmer writes the On Language column for the Sunday New York Times Magazine. You can check out his article on Mad Menis in this weekend's edition of the magazine. Ben's also put together a YouTube clip of some of the anachronisms from Mad Men, and you can link to that on our website, hereandnow.org. And Ben, can I say this? Is this authentic? This has been a real gas. Can I say that?
For the 60s, sure. We heard the Rolling Stones and others use that in the 60s. I think that's appropriate.
All right. Well, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks. But it's all-